You are here on Senate Bill 320. So we'll do a public hearing on Senate Bill 320. Senator DeBevoise.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for giving a hearing to this, what I consider a very important bill. SB 320 provides that in an action based upon injury, wrongful death, financial fraud, or environmental hazard, all documents shall be presumed to be public information and may not be kept confidential. There is provisions in the bill in Section 2, Subsection 2, Parts A, B, and C, however, that protects trade secrets, confidential business information, and confidential personal information. Over the years, we have witnessed several horrific events that have taken place that could have been prevented by the public disclosure of information relating to defective products, financial fraud, or environmental hazard. These events have convinced me that court-ordered secrecy agreements adversely affect public safety and should be eliminated with provisions for legitimate trade secrets, confidential business information, and confidential personal information still protected. Confidential settlements and protective orders drive up the transaction costs of litigation by forcing consumers injured by these products to build their case against a company from scratch. Oregon consumers are put at risk when courts are allowed to hide or keep secret corporate documents related to worker and consumer safety. Court secrecy allows companies to shield information that demonstrates a repeated practice of treating consumers illegally and unfairly. I'd like to cite five specific examples to the committee, although there are probably dozens and dozens of examples that could be cited. The first one, Fultz versus State Farm Mutual Auto Insurance Company, 1994. Salem resident Debbie Fultz charged State Farm, her insurer, with defrauding her by conducting a sham review of her son's need for medical treatment. Fultz accused the insurance company of hiring a California company to issue fraudulent medical reports that favored the insurance company. Fultz charged that State Farm employed the practice to deliberately hold down costs. The case was settled in late 1998. As part of the settlement, a court order was entered sealing over 450 documents in the case file, wiping the docket sheet clean and erasing the case from the court's computer system. Oregon consumers should have the right to know the details of actions by a major insurance company that were potentially used to defraud them. Case 2, probably one of the best known cases, Ford Firestone, a widely known example of disastrous consequences of secrecy agreements, is the tragedy resulting from dangerous defects in Firestone tires, which have been reportedly caused more than 150 deaths and more than 500 injuries worldwide. For many years, Bridgestone Firestone Incorporated knew about the dangerous defects but kept the information out of the public eye by secretly settling many lawsuits brought as a result of crashes related to defective tires. During that time, consumers continued to drive on Firestone tires unaware of the mortal dangers to their families and themselves. On August 9, 2000, Bridgestone Firestone and Ford Motor Company jointly announced that Firestone would recall over 14 million tires. In the absence of a secrecy agreement, information about this dangerous product could have been disclosed publicly, which would have saved lives and avoided many injuries. Case 3, Home Depot. In November 1999, 79-year-old Mary Penteroff was shopping in a California Home Depot store when a forklift operator knocked over some lumber and other merchandise stacked several feet above her. Mary was crushed to death in front of her daughter. When the family sued, they discovered that Home Depot knew of similar accidents and that the company had settled numerous cases confidentially. When Penteroff's daughters realized this, they refused a confidential deal. Case 4, Zomax. Thousands of senior citizens and others who suffer from arthritis were prescribed the pain medication Zomax during the 1980s. Within 5 years of the drug's release, Zomax had been identified as a factor in 14 deaths and 403 life-threatening allergic reactions. Victims in 43 states filed lawsuits. McNeil Laboratories, makers of Zomax, settled the first cases but insisted on confidentiality. Not even the Food and Drug Administration was notified of the drug's legal side effects. Not until victims began to refuse to agree to confidentiality agreements did these dangers become public, and was the public protected? Final case, General Motors. General Motors sold nearly 10 million pickup trucks between 1973 and 1987 with dangerously placed fuel tanks, which caused at least 750 fire deaths during crashes. In 1973, at the beginning of the sales of these cars, a GM engineer wrote a memo noting that the tanks could be expected to cause hundreds of deaths each year, but that the cost of fixing the problem would exceed the cost of settling those death claims. The first victims all settled their case, and GM insisted on confidentiality as part of those settlements. The risks of the trucks were not made public until nearly 15 years after the design was first introduced. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, 16 states have taken the necessary steps to ensure public safety risks are not hidden from public view in public forums. By ensuring that proof of an unnecessary risk do not become buried in public courthouses, these states have found a better balance between the public's right to know and the litigants' right to privacy. None of these states limits sealing criminal records. No divorce or other family court matters are affected. These rules do not mandate the release of patients' medical records, trade secrets, patents, and other proprietary information would not be opened to competitors, but the public would be protected in instances where a product is found to present a legitimate safety hazard. These rules ensure that the public will learn of the dangers among them sooner rather than later, and that defendants will not take advantage of an injured victim's weakened state to demand secrecy in return for a swift resolution to their claim. By joining these states, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Oregon can take a giant step forward to ensure that citizens here and across the nation learn sooner rather than later. Some products may be exceptionally risky. Manufacturers, too, can receive advance warning of potential problems with products, designs, or manufacturing techniques, and the courthouses of this nation and this state will no longer serve as the burial place for deadly secrets. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I know that there is some controversy surrounding this particular bill. I know that the bill has opposition. I would hope that the committee would see the overall public purpose behind the bill, the overall public good that was created, and weigh that against some of the concerns that have been expressed. And if those concerns are not adequately addressed in the bill, give the drafters of the bill the time to meet with the parties that have their concerns if they want to meet in a legitimate forum and actually resolve these differences so that we can come forward with legislation that protects the public's interests and protects their interests also.
All right, Senator, any questions? Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry for the delay this morning. I have two questions. Actually, one is a comment and then a question. First of all, I think this is a fabulous bill. And let me say that in 1999, in my first session, I brought legislation to address tour companies who took teenagers on trips to Mazatlan. They got them drunk, endangered their lives. There was lots going on. Little did I know that four other children had died in these previous trips with this company. They've finally gone out of business, but those people all signed confidentiality agreements when they settled. So no one was the wiser until we discovered some things on our own. So let me ask you this, because I know that you're probably aware one of the objections that is going to be raised today, that it's a disclosure of intellectual property if we allow all of this information out there. So how would you address that, Senator?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, we've made an attempt to address that by putting those provisions in the bills relative to trade secrets and relative to other proprietary information. I think that those sections are adequate. I'm sure others will testify that they're not. I would say, though, that if there are concerns that the committee would like to be addressed, I would like to see the opportunity to actually find some ways to address those concerns within the bill. Well, I can see the concerns that some of these parties might express. I think, actually, justice, whether it's in the civil justice system or whether it's in the criminal justice system, is always a weighing. And I think the overall public's right to know about products that create danger to them, their families, their children, outweighs some of the concerns that you will hear later here today. And I think if we legitimately approach this bill with an open mind, we can resolve some of those concerns.
Follow-up question. You would admit, wouldn't you, Senator, that it's not just limited to products. It runs the gamut of anything from a tour operator to a product to just about anything.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, I fully acknowledge that it goes beyond products. It happens to be that my personal experience is with products, while your personal experience, Senator Walker, is with services being provided.
Thank you, Senator.
All right. Senator, a couple of questions. The cases that you cited, the five cases, are those cases that were tried in state courts or federal court?
Mr. Chairman, I would have to check on each case and get that information back to you.
And then you had you said that there were like 20 states? That had
16 states,
16
Mr. Chairman.
States. All right. Do you have a list of those states?
Yes, we can get that for you also.
And can you provide your testimony, your written testimony?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Any other questions? Senator Hinkle.
Well, Senator Devlin, thank you for your courage and leadership in bringing this important bill today. I did want to ask why you've limited it to these three instances of product, financial fraud, environmental hazard. Obviously, Senator Walker raised a question that wouldn't be covered under this bill. And it seems like it's pretty narrowly tailored, and I just wondered if was that intentional? You didn't want to have too broad of a sweep?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, sometimes when you propose a bill that is on the edge in the sense that it's an important bill to have passed, you narrow the scope of the bill to improve the chances of the bill actually passing through the body. That's a pretty frank statement. Mr. Chairman, if...
You easily could have written the bill broader to include all litigation.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ringo, yes, that's true. We could have.
Okay. Thank you.
There would probably be more people in the audience if we did that.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, if it's with your indulgence, we will provide those materials to you within the next 48 hours.
That's fine. Appreciate that. All right. We have a Sten Piucci. Well, that's a stab at that. I don't know if I got it right or not, but there you go.
Sten.
I'm good at butchering people's names, so forgive me if you will.
Mr. Chair and Senators, I am Steve Piucci. You pronounced my last name absolutely correctly, and that is puts you in a small minority.
My name's Minus. Everybody go Minus, sir.
I appreciate that.
So, yeah.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Steve Piucci. I am a trial lawyer. I am testifying on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association and as a parent and a husband and a dad. Senator Devlin is correct in citing the five examples that he has spoken about today, but I would also ask you to consider one word, and that is Enron. This bill seeks to keep openness in the court system, which is obviously one of the prime tenets of a democratic society. I've put down two main points here. One is that this is bad for families, and in the example cited by Senator Devlin, that's pretty well set forth, especially with respect to the recent Ford Firestone problems. Many people died or became quadriplegics because the information about the tire tread separation issue was buried in secret settlements. That would not have happened had the light of day shown on this information. But with respect to financial fraud, and that would include insurance fraud, by the way, and by people, not necessarily insurance companies, but financial fraud, when buried in confidential settlements, really does hamstring law enforcement. If you have a secrecy agreement that is sealed and signed off on by the courts, public information that may arise to the criminal conduct level is also sealed therein. And currently there are a lot of law enforcement agencies waiting for the hearings on Enron and the cases about Enron to develop before they make their move. And I think that really highlights a non-product, non-tort issue that we have in America today. So I bring that to your attention. The other thing that I'd like to say and point out is that Oregon law actually provides for open and anti-secrecy situations. I've cited it in my materials, but Oregon Revised Statute 30.402 prohibits confidential settlements by a public body. And as with this bill, it allows those affected adversely, perhaps, by this prohibition, to come in and seek a hearing in camera, meaning in a judge's chambers, to seek the protection that they're looking for. If an individual's interest outweighs the public right to know, a judge can, with respect to claims against the state or governmental bodies, they can't seal the information if it's called for. And this has been on the books for over 10 years, and I will promise you that this has not been a scientific approach, but I could not find in the last couple of days any evidence that there had been a problem with this particular bill that's been in effect. Senate Bill 320 would give greater protections to those seeking to protect such things as trade secrets, confidential business information, or confidential personal information by allowing that group or person to, again, meet with the judge and show not that that there is a very high standard here, but, for example, that there is any confidential business or personal information in there that it should not be made public. We can think of many examples, say, in a family law setting where certain things shouldn't be brought to the public light. The trial lawyers and those people backing this bill to date, I am unaware of anybody who has an anti-high-tech bent on this. This bill has been designed so that high-tech or other corporations that have legitimate concerns about business information can get the relief that they need by seeking a protective order. In fact, it's designed so that unless there is a protective order, everything will be secret. But that would put everybody on notice that if you've got an issue in a case, go get it. You can get it during discovery. You can get it before discovery if you can show that important business proprietary information should remain confidential. So I'd be happy to take any questions, but I would reiterate what Senator Devlin has said. This is a growing movement. It has been adopted in various forms in the 16 states already. I would conclude by saying that the two states with the most strict and long-standing sunshine laws, meaning let the sunshine on the information, are Texas and Florida. And recently, a judicial conference was held in Honolulu, and the Roscoe Pound Institute, which invites judges from all over the country, had a forum on secrecy. And the question was posed to these judges from mostly Hawaii, but from around the country, is can anyone cite a case in which there was not a settlement or that there was more litigation because of secrecy laws? Nobody had the example. In hearings in Florida, I believe that they are fully in support of their secrecy bill, as well as in Texas, or anti-secrecy bill. So, the fear that the sky may fall is probably just that. There seems to be no evidence that this has been a problem for business or for government. So, I'd be happy to address any questions you may have. Thank you for letting me speak.
All right, Mr. Pucci. The question I guess I have is whether or not the states that have passed laws like this, whether or not that's forced litigation into the federal court system and what the federal court system's rules are with respect to this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The federal issue is an interesting one because currently in South Carolina now a federal judge is championing a rule in its local district to allow no secrecy agreements whatsoever in the District of South Carolina. That is being tinkered with because there are legitimate concerns with respect to high-tech or other corporate proprietary information, and apparently there's a work group in South Carolina addressing that. When you asked Senator Devlin about whether these five listed cases were in state or federal courts, I guess I could bring you to the Firestone Ford issues. They were brought in every forum where someone was injured or died, and so there really is no distinction between state and federal filings, except that, as in every federal case, the state law of that circuit or where the incident occurs would apply. So the federal courts would honor the state court laws in their federal court cases.
All right. So then, if 16 states have done this, why couldn't the information be gathered through those 16 states that already have sunshine legislation? In other words, if you've got a case like Firestone, why not file in one of the 16 states that has a sunshine law?
Well, perhaps the information could be gathered from states which would release the information, but you can only file a case where the law provides. And if we had, for example, Ann Kirkwood, you might remember several sessions back, she's a resident of Madras, was in a car accident where a side saddle gas tank, a GM gas tank, not her car, collided with her, and she had her family with her, grandson. She was terribly burned, horribly burned. I know she gave testimony here, and Senator Clarno actually led the fight to extend the statute of limitations on these kinds of cases because Oregon law would not let her bring her claim due to the statute of limitations, and she was stuck with Oregon law. She was fortunately able to bring her claim and did recover money. But and in fact, she's living quite nicely in Madras now, thanks to that. But we're stuck with where the situs of the accident occurs. We can get information from other places, but if you can't bring a claim here, that's a problem. And that's really kind of a sideline to this bill. We can bring cases here, but if you bring them against anybody besides the state of Oregon or a governmental entity, secrecy agreements are currently allowable and enforceable.
All right. So as a trial attorney, what would be the benefit of filing in state court as opposed to federal court? How do you go through that process of deciding?
Well, sometimes you don't have a right to file in federal court.
Okay.
If we're... you and I get in a car collision, we're both Oregon residents, we don't have diversity of citizenship. If I'm involved in a collision with someone from Idaho, we do have diversity of citizenship, and then we can go to a federal court. But most cases cannot be filed in federal court.
All right. Other questions?
Mm-hmm.
Senator Ringo, Senator Walker.
I guess I just want to make sure I understand Mr. Chair, your concern about the federal court issue. Is it that confidentiality agreements are not enforceable in federal court right now?
No, my assumption would, which I was hoping somebody could, shed some light on, would be that if we did in fact pass a law that opened up the Sunshine Rule in Oregon court, would that force filings in federal court where there is a confidentiality requirement?
Okay. I mean, even if you had a case filed in federal court, wouldn't they be applying Oregon law with respect to the enforceability of a confidentiality agreement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, yes, they would have to. That's my understanding.
Okay.
There really is no federal law per se. There are procedural rules in federal court, but the law of the district in which the court sits, the state law, applies substantively.
How about large-scale class action suits, so where you've got multiple participants in various states. Those are usually federal court.
I'm sorry, Chair.
Aren't those usual federally?
Class actions?
Yes.
I believe most of the time they are.
So they're in federal court. So class action suit, GM, they're in federal court. This wouldn't really affect that at all. You have multiplicity of states. You have multiplicity of laws. I assume the federal court's going to do...
Mr. Chair, you're now getting out of my experience. I've never had a class action, so I couldn't state that I'm any kind of expert on that, but I believe that where the case is filed is still where the state controlling law would be applied.
All right. Counsel, you have any opinion on that?
I think a lot of class actions rely on federal law. I mean, for example, you could have a Fair Credit Reporting Act that is in federal court because it's alleging the violation of a federal law. That's why it finds its way in federal court. Now, whether this a confidentiality agreement would apply there, I don't know the answer to that.
I guess what I'm looking at is, I mean, it may be good for Oregon law to have the sunshine, but if it forces litigation in the federal court system, and lawyers now look to the federal court system, then, I mean, maybe that's good because it'll take some of the pressure off of the state courts.
Well, my thought, Mr. Chairman, is that the agreement itself would be a contract unless it is entered as a stipulated judgment in federal court, and contracts law is usually state-based.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Contracts law is pretty uniform across the states, and I'll rely on the restatement, but interpretation of contracts usually goes by the law of the state where the contract was entered. So whether it was in federal court or state wouldn't really matter.
All right.
There is no federal common law per se, like there is in the state court.
All right. Thank you. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pucci, I was surprised to hear that Texas is one of the states that has had one of the longest standing laws in this area because they execute more people per capita than anybody else. I didn't think they cared about their
It's
citizens.
Not a product liability thing.
But my question is, how long is this a recent trend for these 16 states? If Texas and Florida have had their law on the books longest, do you know when they first passed this legislation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I believe that Florida's is the longest standing law in the country, and that went back to the late 80s, I believe. Texas followed soon thereafter, and most of the other 14 states that have adopted these kinds of laws have been more recent than that.
Okay. My other question is, you sort of talked about it, the statute of limitations on product liability. That would be the statute of ultimate repose, would it not?
Well, there are two. There are there's a statute of limitations, but then because sometimes you don't discover that there was harm, the statute hasn't started yet, but the 8-year statute of ultimate repose in products cases still exists today.
And we've had difficulty in getting that changed in Oregon, so it seems to me if we're not willing to extend the statute of ultimate repose, that the least we could do is expand information available to the public so we can get that information sooner. Would you not agree?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I would agree to that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you done?
I'm done.
All right. Mr. Pucci, thank you very much for your
Thank you very much.
Mr. Dixon, Steve Dixon. Morning, sir.
Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Steve Dixon. I'm the consumer advocate for the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, OSPIRG. We're a statewide nonpartisan, nonprofit public interest research and advocacy organization with 25,000 members throughout the state of Oregon. And I'm here today to support Senate Bill 320 and to voice OSPIRG support of that bill. Tens of thousands of consumers are injured each year by hazardous products, and only some of them file lawsuits. In determining if a manufacturer is guilty of producing dangerous products, one victim can generate a public record that provides consumers with information about risks. But when court records are hidden from view due to secrecy agreements, which happens all too often, critical public health and safety information is lost. The result is that consumers and regulatory agencies can lack information required to take prudent steps to avoid preventable and needless deaths and injuries. And the media is also deprived of its ability to get the word out to consumers en masse about potential dangers that consumers face. The fact is, secrecy agreements cost lives. Unfortunately, history is replete with examples from the asbestos industry's insistence on the confidentiality of asbestosis, which, sorry, I kind of stumbled through that medical term, as far back as the 1930s, to more recent cases involving the pharmaceutical industry, the auto industry, toy, healthcare, and tobacco industries. Many of these examples are documented by the Coalition for Consumer Rights, and I've attached some of them to my testimony for you to view at a later date. We've heard much about the Ford Firestone incident, and fortunately, Ford Firestone ended up recalling 14 million tires only after many cases were settled and sealed, and many lives were lost, and many injuries were sustained. However, this debacle would have gone on indefinitely had some information not leaked to the media. A plaintiff's attorney involved in the Ford Firestone litigation managed to release documents before the company has agreed to settle. And according to that attorney, Tab Turner, the documents were, and this is a quote, in response to misstatements made by Ford in the media, and the media began to better understand the truth surrounding the entire situation. Had protective orders been in place, we never could have released the documents, end quote. One cannot help but wonder what unnecessary dangers to public health and safety are being posed to Oregonians due to existing secrecy agreements, which is why Osberg supports this bill and encourages you to support it as well. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
All right. Any questions of Mr. Dixon? There are none. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Jim Craven. Yes, Jim Craven, AEA, American Electronics Association.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Craven. I represent the National Trade Association, the American Electronics Association, which is the nation's largest trade association representing the high-tech industry. We have about 3,800 companies nationwide and about 180 members here in Oregon. I guess I should feel honored by all the preemptive testimony references to the testimony that I'm going to give here about the high-tech industry and intellectual property and such, but I'm going to give it anyway, and I appreciate being so singled out by the previous witnesses. The high-technology industry has substantial concerns about Senate Bill 320 because it places the protection of intellectual property, including confidential research, development, and commercial information at risk. Senate Bill 320's broad terms, lack of a meaningful burden of proof for the disclosure, and its removal of judicial discretion result in a presumption of disclosure in product defect, environmental hazard, and securities cases, even when there is insufficient proof to show a nexus between the claimed injury and the alleged hazard. This is a significant departure from existing law, and the result will be, in our minds, a loss of protection for intellectual property rights, increased litigation, and a negative impact on the Oregon economy. Senate Bill 320 includes numerous provisions that would prove very damaging to Oregon's high-tech industry. There's no guarantee that there will be any appropriate determination that there's a nexus between the material sought to be disclosed, the purported defect, and the claimed injury. Under Senate Bill 320, the court does not need to make such a finding prior to disclosure. The bill remains overly broad, and I'll come back to that in a minute with some of the actual words and phrases in the bill. And we think that the bill provides no meaningful procedural protections for appellate review. The ability to protect intellectual property from unauthorized use lies at the very foundation of the high-tech economy. The loss of the ability to protect property rights in one's products will severely impact our industry in Oregon. The protections granted by Senate Bill 320 for trade secrets are largely illusory, in that much of the information vital to the high-tech industry does not meet the narrow definition of a, quote, trade secret. For example, certain research and development may not qualify as a trade secret. But in an industry where R&D drives the development of new products, new technologies, new businesses, and new jobs, its protection from disclosure without legal foundation is imperative. We also think the vague standards included in the bill will increase litigation costs, both in terms of dollars and time, for all parties. We feel that rather than accomplishing its stated goal, Senate Bill 320 will add to the burden on the court system, slow if not halt discovery in many cases, and in the case of a high-tech business, put the very existence of the company at risk. Senate Bill 320 is unnecessary in our minds, and we believe it will lead to increased litigation. In fact, under the terms of Senate Bill 320, one can envision lawsuits being brought on untenable claims whose real purpose is to force settlement based upon the defendant's desire to stay in business by protecting its intellectual property. And we think this is an inappropriate use of the courts. That concludes my formal testimony, but just a couple of observations. There are phrases in this bill that talk about something being capable of causing personal injury. There is a phrase on environmental hazard, threatened or poses a threat. It's these kind of words that give us a little bit of pause in terms of the actual drafting, the details. It's one thing to talk about the 10,000-foot level issue of disclosure is good and it will help protect people. It's another thing, we're down to an actual bill in front of us with real language that we need to read and take seriously in the way the bill is constructed. There's also, you know, we've talked about here about Enron and Firestone Tires and Zomax and a lot of other well-known cases. But the sub 3 in Section 1, we think is probably the most important issue to our industry, and that's fairly vague language about fraudulent investment products. Securities litigation is a huge interest for our industry. Something like one out of four of our national members, of the 3,800 companies that participate in AEA, have been sued over some claim of fraud on the market, fraud on securities, etc. And we have been, in our minds, hate to use a strong word, called shaken down for billions of dollars in such settlements. So, you know, while the testimony preceding me focused on bodily harm and death and such, that's not really, I don't know that our industry is much of a focus for those types of actions. But the inclusion of the third part here about investment, which we think alludes to securities litigation, is of extreme importance to our industry. California has had an enormous battle over this almost same bill for the last at least three sessions in Sacramento. It has not yet passed, to my knowledge. Even when the bill last year was limited to great bodily injury or wrongful death, you know, even when the bill was focused down to the issue really addressed by the previous witnesses this morning, has not made it through the process in California. Some of that was done to address our industry's concerns in California, that if the debate is about exploding tires and dangerous drugs, then the debate should be about those things and not slip in other issues like possibility of environmental hazard or securities issues. I would welcome taking a look at the other 16 state statutes. I don't have those. I think it would be helpful for this committee, other than just a list of 16 states, a matrix that shows exactly what's in those bills, because saying that 16 states have done something along these lines, I think it would be helpful to know exactly what those 16 states have done. Have they included these three things? Have they had this basic framework, or is it something else? I think that would be helpful for this whole discussion. Finally, I just want to close that we're willing to continue to discuss this issue with this committee. It is of critical importance to our industry in all the states in which it has been introduced, and it will be of critical importance to our industry here in Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
All right, Jim, it was testified to earlier that Texas has a sunshine law. It comes to mind that Texas is a state that has quite a bit of microchip electronics industries.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
So your question about how other states' laws are constructed, I think, is a good one. It makes me wonder why, if this is a bad law for Oregon, why electronics firms are citing themselves in Texas.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is a good question. I will do what I can to find out the details of the Texas law. So I think it is important. We are into the devils in the details, and we see a lot of details in this bill, and we'll try to match those up with the Texas law and find out exactly what the Texas scheme is.
All right. Make sure that I understand your concern. Subsection 3 of Section 1 on page 1 of the bill, that you said that was a major interest or a major concern?
Pardon me?
The financial fraud means any fraud, fraudulent insurance practice, or any fraudulent plan or scheme to sell an investment product.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
That is a major
That is a
issue?
Major concern in this
okay.
draft.
The question I have for you, isn't fraudulent a key word here?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at the risk of practicing law without a license, I think the issue here is not if something has been adjudicated to be fraudulent, that's one thing.
Right.
This bill covers a broad range of discovery prior to actual adjudication of fact, and that's part of the concern with the way the bill works. Something is only, and again, the lawyers in the room can help me here, I believe something is only fraudulent if it has been deemed fraudulent in a court of law or through some kind of stipulated agreement.
But doesn't this bill apply to cases that are concluded or adjudicated?
Pardon me?
Wouldn't this bill apply to adjudicated cases?
I believe so, but I believe its net is much broader than that. It applies to any type of litigation. Litigation doesn't always result in an adjudication.
But the disclosure of information, that wouldn't be occurring during the course of the trial. This, I assume, is talking about after the case has been concluded.
Senator Minnis, I will let your staff and others help me with this, but I believe the net is much broader. We're not talking about records that are closed after someone has been convicted and found guilty. We're talking about all the broad range of discovery that goes on way before you get to the actual determination of fact, and that's really the heart of the bill and the heart of the concern.
All right, but would you be fine with if after the adjudication that the documents were not sealed and made public?
Mr. Chair, I'm practicing without a license here, so
okay.
I will need to get back to you on that.
You're not practicing anything. You can even lie to us legally here.
I think that's illegal, Mr. Chair.
We can't in the House, but you can over here.
Yeah. All right, anyway, I'm done. Senator Ringo, Senator Walker.
Thank you.
Well, again, I'm amazed the American Electronics Association wants to help farmers insurance cover up fraud and the makers of defective products cover up dangerous products. And for you to come and give this spiel that contains, I think, so many blatant errors, I'm amazed that you would do that. To suggest this would increase litigation, and I guess I'd like to explore that a little bit. Why? Tell us again why you think this will increase litigation.
Mr. Chair, I am not, Senator Ringo, I am not here defending fraudulent insurance practices or defective products. I am pointing out issues I have with the specifics of the bill.
Mr. Chair, one of the purposes of this is to try to clamp down on fraudulent practices. And rather than just attacking this on 20 different points, I would find it a lot more helpful if you would help us in that effort. Instead of obstructing our effort to clamp down on financial fraud.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I am pointing out issues that we have with the bill as it's drafted, with the actual language of the bill, and analysis that my members have done of this issue. That's what I'm here to do today.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I mean, Jim, you're familiar with protective orders. Are you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I am not a member of the bar. I am relying upon people who are members of the bar who have helped me with this testimony.
Well, protective orders are routinely entered into in litigation where there is proprietary information involved. And sometimes it's of a technical nature, or sometimes it's just of a private business nature, where one business competitor doesn't want to know how another competitor does their business pricing, for example. And all those documents are routinely disclosed in the course of litigation, and that's just the course of doing business. And I, as one of the witnesses testified, Steve Cucci, over the last several years, there's not been one example of protective orders being abused. And this, the protective orders are designed to allow litigation to proceed, even though the subject may involve confidential information. And I don't see how, given the existence of enforceable protective orders, how there's any legitimate claim that this is going to harm the proprietary interests of the high-tech industry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, as it has been explained to me, the language in Section 2, lines 24 through 26, does mention that protective orders are allowed for confidential business information. I mean, that phrase is in there, and that's certainly helpful and warranted in any kind of construction like this. I think what has been expressed to me is the actual language of the bill, such that this is not something a company can just assert. The scheme here would be cannot be edited in a manner to prevent that disclosure, and the disclosure would cause serious competitive and economic harm to the party opposing disclosure.
But excuse me, disclosure would not happen. Disclosure would not happen because you've got an enforceable protective order. And this bill isn't going to disclose information subject to a protective order.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, but doesn't this bill proscribe and narrow the grounds upon which a defendant can ask for a protective order?
Not at all.
That's my reading of what's essentially at issue here, is that a protective order, a court may not enter a protective order for a document unless one of the following applies. So it is a, in other words, you cannot ask and get enforceability of a protective order unless you can prove, the defendant can prove these, you know, factual information that supports these issues.
Well, I would be happy to explore that with you further. And if that's really your basis for this, I would like to address it and try to remove that as a basis for your objection, because I don't think the proponents of this bill in any way want to take confidential information, parade it for the public. I mean, believe me, I have no interest in doing anything that would harm the development of a high-tech industry. But I do want to encourage a harsh, cold light to be brought on bad practices, and I would think you would too. And so let's work together on that rather than just coming up and giving a broad-based blast at something where I really think you're off base.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringel, we can agree to disagree.
Okay. Mr. Chair? I guess I would appreciate the counsel's assistance in going through some of these issues in a little more detail. I think there's many examples where confidentiality agreements have run against the public interest, and that we can make settlements public without in any way interfering with legitimate claims of a proprietary interest. And nobody wants that to happen. So let's just find a way to craft this bill so that we don't have that concern.
Right. Good. And Jim, just for your admonishment, Senator Curry only pointed out ORS 171525, immunities of witnesses before legislative committee. Says any testimony given by a witness before any legislative committee shall not be used against the witness in any criminal action or proceeding.
What, is that just criminal action, though,
or
Mr. Chair?
It is not. Or proceeding, which my assumption is that is any proceeding. That's what it says. Any criminal action or proceeding. Nor shall any criminal action or proceeding be brought against any such witness on account of any testimony so given by the witness except perjury committed before the committee.
Mr. Chair, we also have, as a capital club, we also have a code of ethics that precludes not telling the truth in this building.
All right, but that's privately regulated. Senator Perry,
Mr. Chairman, the testimony of the witness, I thought, contained very specific objections to the language of the bill, but in deference to Senator Ringo's issue, it also included an offer to work on improving the functions of the bill and removing some of the concerns. At least that's what I heard. So I guess I'd just suggest that maybe there is a middle ground here that we need to pursue. Maybe a working group.
All right. Thank you. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to follow up on that, I think, you know, even the criminal defense lawyers come here and say, we hate this bill, and here's why. And so often what we do is we get people who say they hate this bill and hear all the bad things, but they don't give us things that would make it better and more palatable. So I think that's where some of the comments, at least mine, would come from. But, Mr. Craven, I have a question for you. The chair brought up the fact that Texas, there's a lot of electronics. But, you know, we have 16 states who have these laws, and your comment about needing a matrix to see exactly what those laws are all about is appropriate, and I would suggest that Senator Devlin might put that together. But you indicate that your organization, you have 3,800 companies nationwide. So one would assume that you have some companies in those 16 states. So could you please share with us concern about your companies nationwide, if they have any in those 16 states, and how that law has impacted them? I think that's the kind of testimony I would like to hear from you.
Thank you, Senator. I mean, I'm not prepared to do that instantaneously, but I will pursue that.
Yeah, I would ask you to go back to your 3,800 companies and ask them how it has changed their working environment in those 16 states.
All right. Mr. Craven, thank you very much for being brave enough to come in front of the committee. You don't have a lot of backup from the business community today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sure there's many people in this building right behind me.
I'm sure.
If not at the current moment.
All right. We'll conclude the public testimony on Senate Bill 320. Senator Corcoran is here on Senate Bill 356, creating truth verification examiner licensing process. Senator Corcoran, you're on. Thank you for being so patient.
No, it was fascinating.
What's he here for?
Truth verifications.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Given the previous discussion, we should have heard this bill first. I have with me today Lane County Sergeant Matt Keedle, who I've been in communication with, and Sheriff Jan Clements since November on moving this bill forward. This is Sergeant Keedle here, and he will carry the bulk of the explanation to you. We also have a guest from out of state, Mr. Bill Endler, who's a former police chief from Syracuse, Indiana, and is a member of the National Institute of Truth Verification, which is a company involved in the computer voice stress analyzer. I provided you the same background information that Sergeant Keedle and Sheriff Clements provided me, and I think you'll see a pretty broad base of support for this in other venues. There's a list of other agencies who have been involved in this, and I believe, Mr. Chair, without having any expertise in this area at all, that this, in fact, may be one of the solutions we look at in terms of the budget crisis as we face a future with less ability to use polygraph in criminal investigations, and this may be a tool to assist us in that. And I suggest we try it out on the House first, since they're already making their witnesses claim to tell the truth. So I have to go settle a little matter called PERS, so I'm going to go do that right now and leave this to these two fine gentlemen. And we'll be providing the Sergeant Keedle's told me that he has not been able to have a long discussion with other jurisdictions about this particular bill, and he is going to go out and seek some more endorsements along with their lobbyist, Mr. Powell, as a result of this hearing. But thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill.
All right, and I can recognize your wisdom in leaving. All right, thank you. All right, so gentlemen, if you'd just identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Hi, I'm Matthew Keedle. I'm a sergeant in the criminal investigation section with the Lane County Sheriff's Department.
Okay.
My name is William Endler. I'm a retired chief of police from Syracuse, Indiana. I'm currently employed by the National Institute for Truth Verification out of West Palm Beach, Florida.
All right, great. So who's starting off?
Officer, I'll do that.
Good.
I do bring you good news. I'm not here to ask for any money. I'm here to in support of Senate Bill 356 and also representing Sheriff Jan Clements from Lane County Sheriff's Department, who issued a letter, which you have a copy of, in support of the bill. And my interest, I'm here to testify as the working person who does this on an everyday basis, does the investigations. And with the passage of this bill, it'll allow us additional tools to do our investigations. I first became familiar with the voice stress analyzer a little over a year ago, and while we were conducting a death investigation, and one of the parties that we needed to interview was down in California. We contacted the agency down there because the person had agreed to take a polygraph, and when I called down there, I was surprised that they no longer used the polygraph and that they only used the stress analyzer for those types of interviews. So after talking with this investigator for a while, I logged on to the Internet and got onto the website for one of the companies, the one that Mr. Endler represents, with the voice stress analyzer. And I on that website, there's agencies across the country who use this thing. So I just started calling. I called East Coast, West Coast, North, South, everywhere you can think, and contacted numerous agencies. Not one of the agencies that I contacted had anything bad to say about the voice stress analyzer. Many of them have converted from the polygraph and are using that now. I've come to find out that there's only 8 states left that don't have legislation that allows the use of a voice stress analyzer.
Could you do me a favor?
Yes, sir.
Could you just tell me what the heck this thing is?
Pardon me?
What exactly is it? Because I'm familiar with polygraphs.
Okay.
But what is a voice stress analyzer? Let's lay that foundation.
Should he maybe explain how that it works?
I can,
it'll probably
I
be better.
Basically, Mr. Chairman and Senators, it works on the same principle as polygraph. It works on your autonomic nervous system. But the big difference is on the polygraph, it records 3 different parameters: your heart rate, your breathing, and your what they call the galvanic skin response, which is basically the 2 things that they place on your fingers, which monitors your sweat glands. However, the computer voice stress analyzer, basically what we do is we just put a microphone to you, we ask you the questions, and we record your voice, and we are able to tell basically by the voice print patterns whether you are under stress or not.
Now, is it similar to polygraph in terms of questioning where you ask a truthful question?
Yes.
And you get a baseline
exactly.
With respect
yes,
to a truthful
is.
Answer and then
right.
Right. Identify it's the questions that you're going to ask, which are the
right.
False questions. You don't
They're called control questions. We have control questions. We have irrelevant questions. We also have relevant questions that we ask.
So very similar process.
Very similar.
To polygraph.
Yes. Just different technology,
all
basically.
Right.
Same
thanks.
Thing.
Thank you for that.
That's fine.
Sir.
In the western portion of the United States, we have Washington, California, Arizona, Alaska, Utah are all using the voice stress analyzer. Some of the big advantages for us is right now we work with Oregon State Police who conduct all of our polygraph examinations. And our local examiner down in Lane County, Steve Hapner, works his tail off for us. He does an excellent job. However, he's overloaded. Currently, he's responsible for taking care of polygraphs for 3 counties. And I'm told by his supervisor there it's likely to expand. His area of responsibility is about to expand because of budget cuts. Many times in our investigations, we have somebody that we feel is a suspect in a case and that agrees to take a polygraph, and we don't have anybody who's certified to be a polygrapher, and the training that's required to run a polygraph machine versus the stress analyzer is far more intensive. And so many times we have to wait 3 days to 3 weeks to get somebody to a polygraph, and the majority of the time, once you ask somebody and they agree to take the test, when they leave, they change their mind. We lose many interviews this way. Where the training for the stress analyzer is intensive, but it's much shorter. It's much more user-friendly. We're talking a microphone hooked to a person versus all the other items that are needed for a polygraph. This bill would allow us to put that tool into use, and just within Lane County, we'd be able to have, for our sheriff's office, a couple of people trained to use that thing so that if we have somebody available or that's ready to take the test, we can do it right away. I think it'd streamline our investigations. It's fairly new technology, even though it's been around for a couple decades. For me and my people that do the work in these cases, it's simply another tool to allow us to do our investigations without impeding the flow of the investigation.
Now, I'm assuming, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that like the polygraph, this is inadmissible evidence.
That's correct.
So it's used basically as a diagnostic tool.
Absolutely.
As a sex crimes investigator, oftentimes refer some of my suspects to defense attorneys who use polygraphers for the purpose of determining the truthfulness of their statements and then submitting the various records to our polygrapher, and they analyze them and determine whether or not they agree. Mm-hmm. And often we'll, if they're being truthful, we'll stop the prosecution based on that information. But again, it's not admissible in court. In fact, I can't even mention the word.
Correct.
Right, exactly. So, mistrial.
Right. Okay, other questions? Senator Walker and Senator Ferroli.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sergeant Keto, I'm reading the testimony of Sheriff Clements, and something just struck me as kind of odd. I don't know much about polygraphs, but it says this voice stress analyzer can be used if the person recently used drugs or is pregnant. Now, I can understand that drugs impacts the polygraph, but how does being pregnant impact a polygraph?
I'd have to let Mr. Inler answer that.
There are some, and I've been a polygraph examiner for 20 years as well, and there's some belief, I personally never ran a pregnant woman, but there's some belief that you can pick up both heartbeats on the polygraph.
Oh.
So the polygraph is very, very limited when it comes to those sorts of things because of if you've done any drugs, if you haven't had enough sleep, if you're pregnant, several things where the polygraph examiner will not test you. However, we have not found anything that has impaired the CVSA other than certainly if they've taken enough drugs to where you can see it, you know, then certainly you're not going to run them. But the drugs in and of itself have not detracted from the accuracy of the instrument.
And a follow-up question in response to that, if I might. So a lack of sleep also impacts polygraph? I'd never pass one, man, because I never have enough sleep.
Well, what the consensus is if you are extremely tired,
uh-huh.
Your body doesn't have the ability to react.
I see. That seems to me
because it reacts on your central nervous system. Basically, we are raised from the time we're born to fear punishment. This is something that our parents teach us from day one, hopefully, right? And when your brain perceives this punishment, it causes all these physiological changes to occur in your body. And basically, the polygraph records three different parameters, whereas with the CVSA, we just record the one parameter as far as the voice goes. But it does, they basically work the same way.
Hmm.
It's just different technology.
Yeah, well, thank you. It does sound like the polygraph has a lot of failings.
It is much, much easier to use countermeasures on the polygraph to defeat the examination. Yes, it certainly does.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, Senator Ferroli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm curious about whether or not the law enforcement agencies currently have the authority to record a conversation so long as one individual agrees. It's my impression that you can record a conversation so long as one part of the conversation authorized the recording.
As long as you're a participant in the conversation, yeah, you can.
Right. And the follow-up question, Mr. Chairman, would be that the voice stress analyzer will work as well on a recording as it is with the live feed input.
Could you say that again, sir?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the question is, does the analysis of the recording, can that analysis be done just as effectively from a recorded conversation as it could from a live input?
Again, I'd refer that to Mr. Inler.
It can be. However, basically, depending on your recording, you're certainly going to lose some of your accuracy rate. And again, keeping in mind, Senators, that this is a tool. I mean, it's not the be-all, the end-all. What it does for you is it supplies you information to take your case in a certain direction. It will save you investigative time. I mean, in other words, it's like a flashlight on a dark night for a police officer.
Okay.
It's not. Certainly, if someone fails the test, we don't advocate locking them up.
Right.
But it gives you information on a direction to go, and that's really what it is.
And I
think
an example would be, I often use tape recorded conversations with suspects, and in some cases witnesses too, in criminal cases. Even if you did apply this technology, which I'm unfamiliar with, to the recordings that I've used in my investigations, you still wouldn't be able to use that portion of it
right. At
trial. You
exactly.
could use the
exactly.
tape recording, clearly, but you could not use the voice stress analyzer portion of it.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, can I come to closure on this?
Yes. You weren't done?
No. So the question I have is, if it's legal for an individual to make a recording, as long as they're party to the conversation, and this technology is available over the counter, you can buy this technology in lots of places, vendors sell it. Matter of fact, there are desk models, desktop models, there's portable models, you can put it in your pocket. You know, the point is this technology has been around for
You are apparently
years.
Familiar with it.
I am, Mr. Chairman.
He should have disclosed
Speaking
that.
Speaking to the pen, Mr. Chairman.
Spend time
so the question
at
I've got is, if it's legal to use the technology and it's available over the counter, and you can record a conversation at will, as long as you're part of the conversation, why do we need the law? You can do this stuff now. Why do we need to put this in statute? You can't use it in court. It's inadmissible. But you have access to the technology. It's available over the counter. You, as long as you're doing the personal investigation, you can either get the live feed or ask people to voluntarily participate without a statutory approval. And as I say, I'm not sure there's a requirement that we put this in statute.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Farrioli, that actually is a question that has come up in talking with the Legislative Council, and the purpose statement within the ROS seems to, for the ROS, for the use of truth verification devices, the purpose statement itself seems to be very broad and has a potential of saying that the only authorized use of a truth verification device requires that you have to have galvanic skin response, blood pressure, respirations, and those things that apply to a polygraph. The amendment to this Senate bill seems to clarify that portion so that those portions that are required for the polygraph are addressed to a polygrapher or the polygraph and should take the voice stress analyzer out of that. And I think it's just to clarify that portion, because frankly, I agree with you. In the city of Eugene, actually purchased voice stress analyzers 5 years ago, I believe, and it was brought up that, you know, the law appeared to not allow them to use that. The company bought them back, and nobody's addressed that since.
That, Mr. Chairman, actually makes more sense to me now. In other words, clarifying the law to allow the use of the tool makes more sense to me than creating the authority to use the tool that's already clearly vested in law enforcement agencies.
Right. It seems to do something with licensure issues, too.
Could I address that, sir?
Of course.
Chairman and Senators, to give you kind of a background, in the late 70s, early 80s, the American Polygraph Association basically approached all 50 states. We truly believe that it was because of the threat of voice stress analyzers were coming out at that time. And what they did was they applied and what it amounts to is a licensing law, pretty much, which basically describes the instrumentation and describes polygraph examiners as well. And approximately 15 to 17 states put this law into effect. We presently have about approximately 7 to 8 that the law is still in effect. We have we are changing as we go. In other words, Virginia just changed approximately a month ago. My office partner in the office, he's presently in Illinois today. So we're just basically going from state to state to get the, and it just amounts to the terminology describing the instrumentation. And if I could for a second, Senator Friolli, the instruments or gadgets, as we call them, that you can buy over the counter are nothing more than that. We have an instrument that we've put much technical administration into. Also, we only sell to law enforcement. We do not sell to the public. We don't sell any of our instruments to the public sector. There's no private investigators, nothing like that can buy them. We only sell to law enforcement throughout the United States. So there is a big difference with the ones that you can't buy over the counter in IRC, certainly.
Council is asking the question here why we should just repeal the law in the first place. But I think the answer to the question is that the polygraph licensure, there's a certain acceptability of persons who are licensed in terms of qualification. I mean, for instance, the polygrapher who works in the Portland Police Bureau, she doesn't accept just any polygrapher's work. And she wants to know that person's quality, their training, their background, and their history of how they evaluate and how they conduct their tests. So I think the same thing may or may not apply to the truth verification devices that you're talking about, the voice analyzers. I don't know. But even though it's not admissible in court, within the practice, law enforcement, criminal justice arenas, there's a, is this person qualified? Is this person somebody who's reliable? Can we really rely on their statements and their interpretation of the data to determine whether or not the accuracy of the, right. The person's statements are...
I'd be happy to address that, sir, if I could.
Sure.
We have our training course is a 6-day intensive course. It's 8 hours a day in class, at least 2 to 3 hours every night homework. We have a 2-year that we supply with the instrument. We have a 2-year program that we work with the examiner. We help them in question formulation. We have 4 associations throughout the United States that have training programs ongoing. In fact, you have an excellent association that's called the Pacific Association, which is housed in California. We also require that each and every examiner is recertified every 3 years. So they have to go through the program. It's an advanced program, but they must be recertified every 3 years so that they're kept fresh, they're kept up to date on any changes that's made with the instrumentation as well as any new techniques that that come along. So we do have an ongoing program with them. It's not like polygraph. I went through polygraph school in 1983, and since 1983 I have not been required to be updated at all for 20 years. So right. Where we require every 3 years that they are recertified, that they keep their certification, that sort of thing.
All right. Thank you very much. And we don't have anybody from the criminal defense bar out there today. I was going to go look into the question about when polygraph examination material may be entered into.
Well, I know in the state that I'm from, in the state of Indiana, it is admitted under stipulation.
All right. So does both parties stipulate, or can the defense?
Normally, both attorneys will stipulate to it, and the judge will sign the order, and then they take the polygraph. And normally what the case is the prosecutor and the defense attorney will stipulate. If the individual passes the polygraph, they walk. If they don't, then they use it against them.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. And we've got one other gentleman who is in opposition to the bill. Mr. Sullivan.
Thank you for your time, sir.
Okay, thank you, sir. Brian Sullivan. Brian Strickland. Where did I get Sullivan? It says Strickland. I should pay attention. Yeah, I need a drink for a second. Mr. Strickland.
Members of the committee, thank you.
During the 1988 committee meetings regarding the Employee Polygraph Protection Act, the United States Congress issued an explanatory statement advising that polygraph was the only instrument that could be capable or used for lie detection. In 1990, the International Association of Chiefs of Police issued a resolution in support of the polygraph. The IACP, International Association of Chiefs of Police, again came out in support of polygraph in 1995. When the IACP National Law Enforcement Policy Center developed and issued a model policy for the use of polygraph. To date, the AAPP, that's the American Association of Police Polygraphists, is not aware of any national law enforcement association or U.S. government agency involved in law enforcement investigations which has taken similar positions in support of voice stress equipment. Cheese and crackers. Did I put you to sleep with that in the first 5 seconds or what? I'm sure I did. Your mind drifted off to the fight you had with your spouse or what donut you're going to have for lunch today, if you so choose. I am a polygraph examiner. I started my career in law enforcement. I worked for 14 years in law enforcement. I became a polygraph examiner in 1995 with the Medford Police Department. I became acutely interested in the detection of deception. From the spoken word to the nonverbal behaviors to the written word. I became aware of voice stress analyzer in 1996. Wow, what a fantastic tool to use if it works. In fact, my nickname was Inspector Gadget. I'm totally into technology and the uses of it. So I availed myself to the research that surrounded the voice stress analyzer as a potential use for the department's goal of detection of deception. The sergeant that spoke to you, in fact, everybody that would speak to you for a voice stress analyzer, has, with maybe the exception of the manufacturer, has a very true motivation in promoting that use, and that is to hold those accountable that would victimize us as society. So I'm no different than that. I was very interested in using a tool that could be better than polygraph if it worked out. So I started investigating it. And what I found was that the Department of Defense conducted many studies on the use of the voice stress because, after all, the government is very concerned about counterintelligence and the use of any kind of equipment that could detect deception. And what they found was that in their studies that, and you can read about it ad nauseum in any of these publications that I gave you. The first one is produced by the American Polygraph Association, and it's entitled Detection of Deception, Truth versus Myth. And the second one is the American Association of Police Polygraphists. I didn't become aware of this hearing until Thursday last week, so I'm a little bit unprepared to give you the full studies of the research cited. However, I then dismissed that after studying it as something that the police department should use because, the manufacturers of this device only market it to law enforcement for a very good reason. When I was a police polygraphist, I am now in private practice. I became private in 2001. The majority of the cases that I conducted tests on, the persons that I was testing were guilty of the offense I was testing them on. Most of the time, our investigators chased down the leads, developed their suspects, honed in on the one responsible, and submitted him for testing, or her. So, polygraph, like voice stress analysis, became an interrogative prop in that regard. However, in those few cases, say the 2 out of 10, where the cops had no idea who the bad guy was, they just needed to find out. No one person was any more weighted than another. Those accuracy rates become critical. Oregon has always been on the cutting edge of ideas. Take, for example, our bottle bill, the assisted suicide law. So we're not afraid to take the initiative and go out on a limb. But with this, this law, the change to the bill, first of all, voice stress analyzers are not prohibited from use in this state. They simply just must record the cardiovascular pattern, the breathing pattern, and the galvanic skin group pattern in addition to the voice. So the law as it stands is fine. I mean, you use the voice stress as long as you do those things also. So I think on one point there's no need to change it with that regard. Now,
when I became involved in the, after I researched it and decided not to use it, I've had experience with it with a couple of detectives that came up to the PD to use it on a murder case, and shoot, we were in and out of that lady's trailer in about 30 minutes, and they were happy that she had no involvement in the homicide that they were investigating. However, I wasn't so sure, but I won't get into that story. But in any case, when I left the public sector and went into private, as I mentioned earlier, the manufacturers of this device market it to law enforcement because there is a, not on the part of law enforcement, but there's a perceived thought that their collateral damage is okay, like the military. It's like, yes, we realize that most of these people are guilty when we give them the test. However, the ones that are truly not, you know, well, it'll come out in the wash. Well, believe me, if you're at the receiving end of being falsely accused of something you didn't do, it's devastating. Well, maybe you have been. In any case, ironically enough, sometimes the bills that get passed with these things, they're used to determine deception on the part of lawmakers who pass them. Voice stress. I don't want my reputation staked on one parameter. It'd be like hooking you up to a polygraph just to the cardio pattern and making a decision just based on that. With the voice stress, you're only getting one parameter. Now, that being said, I joined two partners in private practice, Rob Lundell and Susan Holmes. Mr. Lundell started Polygraph 22 years ago, and a therapist who managed sex offenders came to him one day and said, you know, can we use the Polygraph to determine if this person is lying to us or not about their sex history or things that they're currently being involved in? Well, that became, he developed the containment model for sex offender management, which is a probation officer, a polygraph examiner, and a therapist. With the three of those people, they put a squeeze play on this individual. A woman named Kim English headed up a staff of five, and they produced this document here, the containment method to sex offender management. I spoke to Kim English this morning, and I asked her, in your travels across the United States, and she interviewed over 700 probation officers, she interviewed countless folks involved in the containment and the management of sexual offenders, and not one of those models used voice stress analyzer. In fact, she's testified in this building before on managing sex offenders, and there's a reason for that. She said, quote, we care about the accuracy with the management of these offenders. The police officers use it as an interrogative prop. So, being acutely aware and concerned with the management of sexual offenders in my community, I understand the devastating consequences to what can happen. And Senator Menace, I'm sure you do too. In fact, all of us do.
Sir, let me interrupt you for just a second. Are you suggesting that this particular equipment is not accurate?
I am suggesting that. Studies that you'll see cited in that literature put the Department of Defense Commission studies on it because they wanted to use it if it worked. Found that the accuracy rate was no better than chance, 48% to 51% accurate.
How does that differ with a polygraph?
Polygraph is 85 to 98% accurate, depending on the competency of the examiner involved. So, if there were a better tool that I could use to contain these people, to keep my community safer, I would throw out the garbage and use the new in a heartbeat. The proponents of proponents of voice stress would argue with the polygraph community that the reason that polygraph examiners don't want to use it is because their jobs would go away. Au contraire, doctors don't go away because new technologies are invented for diagnostics. I simply would switch machines and carry on. My job wouldn't change a bit. I'd fully embrace any technology, and it's coming with that looking into brain waves and blood flows in the brain and eye movement patterns, computer-mapped eye movement patterns. So there's technologies on the horizon that are proving fruitful. Voice stress is not. That's all I have.
That's it.
Questions?
Questions? There are none.
I would like to address one more thing, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Polygraph is admissible in this state for use on, I heard it to talk about that on the speakers before. It is admissible in probation or parole proceedings. So if you're on probation or parole and you're required to take a test, then I can get up and testify to polygraph and the results. It is not admissible in new crimes. Pregnant women aren't tested simply because we don't want to incur liability for an aborted pregnancy. It's not because you can hear the heart rate of the baby. Doing tests right away, as the sergeant from Lane County suggested that they wanted this as to streamline, because I know who Detective Hebner is, and he does do a fantastic job, and he is overworked, and they wanted to help him out. But the reasons why you would not want to do a voice stress right away are the same for polygraph. If the person is, you just contacted them and their wife or husband's dead and they're a suspect in a case and they're a basket case, you don't want to test that person right then. Likelihood of a false positive is great. Okay, that's all.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. We'll close the public hearing. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 332. And we have a sign-up sheet, I assume. Senator Byer's not here, is he? No. Mr. Perry, are you the principal here? I was giving you a lot of credit.
More than I do, I'm sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Perry. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Restaurant Association. And Senator Byer dropped this bill at our request. Currently, right now, employers are used in collections of different matters that aren't associated with the business. One of them, and probably the most common, is child support, being able to go to the employer for the child support. Those statutes actually allow the employer to collect $5 a month as a processing fee in current law today from the paychecks. The other that's becoming more and more common is actually a writ of garnishment that lasts on a 90-day writ usually. And even though the employer is entitled to any fees that are due to them, they can't collect it to the payroll process. And in most of these cases, if somebody is unwilling to pay a bank or a collection agent, they're probably not going to be likely to pay me for my fees. So what we've done here is we've asked that if a writ of garnishment is court ordered, that the employer can collect a dollar a week towards basically payment of processing for that. On the board or on the table, I saw that there's two amendments. The Dash 1 amendments was brought forward by the Department of Justice and Child Support Division, and I will practice law without a license if I can, and somebody can correct me if they want to. On the ORS 25414, as it is applied in subsection 2 of the bill, that actually lumps in the Child Support Division part of it. So right now, under one portion of law, I'm allowed to collect $5 a month. This would allow me to collect another dollar as the bill is written on top of that, and that was not our intent. So what it does is it removes that section of it, so I can't double dip, for lack of a better word. And so the Department of Justice brought that forward, and we're fine with that. That was not our intention. And the second one was actually brought forward by legislative counsel when he was looking at the amendments. He noticed that he made what was, in his opinion, a drafting error, so he replaced in line 9 the first word in the sentence when with an after. I will say that during the interim, we worked with the collection agents and the financial institutions on a compromise bill, and they are okay with this. I've also spoken to members of the labor community, and they have not expressed any concerns to this point with me.
All right, Bill, it's been told to me that there may be some fiscal. Is that the DOJ amendment, or do you know?
That I do not know. I'm not aware. Nobody's expressed a fiscal analysis to me, so I can't answer that question.
All right. Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Perry? There are none. Thank you, Bill. Mm-hmm. And David Niebel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm David Niebel with the Oregon Law Center. We represent low-income people in civil legal matters. And my testimony will be very brief. I would oppose this bill on behalf of Oregon Law Center clients. I worry that this might be the thin end of a wedge where employers begin charging employees for, well, I guess I'll call them services that they've always performed, like preparing payroll. This is simply a cost of doing business for employers, and this is, garnishments are not something that's just sprung up on the scene recently. Employers have been responding to garnishments for, well, I don't know, since medieval England, I would guess, and have not charged employees for their costs. It's a dollar a week that is, I would agree, it's a small amount for the course, over the course of a garnishment, though, which can last more than 90 days. I believe we'd be talking about $13. And $13, when taken out of a paycheck of $200, is a significant amount. So we're talking about low-income workers here, and I would oppose this bill and allow people to keep as much of their paycheck, low-income workers, to keep as much of their paychecks as possible. Thank you, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Niebel, I think the testimony was, and at least the conversation I had with Mr. Perry in my office, was that there has been an alarming number of these that have just increased year after year after year, and it's increasing the cost of doing business. And I assume they've been around since medieval England, but I just don't think that there's been as many as there haven't been in recent years. How would you respond to that? Don't you think an employer needs to find a way to keep costs down?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I would agree with that. I don't know. I am not familiar with statistics about how many garnishments there are now per employee as opposed to how many there were 5 years ago or 10 years ago. I just simply do not know that. So I don't have any factual basis really to respond to Mr. Perry's assertion.
Well, let me follow it up. The reason I ask that is because employers are overwhelmed with insurance costs. Not all of these employees get insurance because some of them are minimum wage jobs, but some do. I mean, some of the high-quality restaurants in Eugene, they don't keep their employees around by not providing them with some benefits. So I'm just hard-pressed to see how $13 over 90 days would be a real burden when an employer is just trying to keep costs down.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I understand that point of view. I'm a bit concerned that we're looking at the beginning of, you know, the erosion of the sort of the sanctity or the inviolability of a person's paycheck when they don't agree to a deduction. I see that we've already done that with child support. I think that's probably a step in the wrong direction also, but it's current law, so I suppose we've already started down this road. But all I would say is that from the point of view of a minimum wage worker, it's important to hold on to as much of those hard-earned wages as that person can.
I agree with that, and I see it's important. If people paid their bills, they wouldn't get in this problem. If they didn't have fines that had to be garnished out of their checks, whatever. There's bankruptcy available to low-income clients if it becomes burdensome for them as well. So we do offer a lot of opportunities for people to get out from under their debt. And I'm just having a hard time seeing this as overly burdensome. And you're right, it could be a slippery slope, as they say around here, but they'd have to come before us again. And I'm not sure that we'd agree the second time.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, David, I guess I'm a little bit conflicted on this because on the one hand, I agree with you. I'd like to see low-income keep a lot of their paychecks. But I've issued writs of garnishment and have imposed on that employer a burden. And some employers are pretty adept at handling writs of garnishment, and others aren't. Others, you know, their accountant isn't a bookkeeping genius, and these laws are complicated. And it seems to me that $1 is a pretty modest sum for having to deal with all the headaches of garnishment. You know, especially, I mean, if they mess up, they're liable. And that puts them in a tough spot.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I understand this is not, for someone who has not dealt with a garnishment before, this is can be a fairly
headache.
Complicated. Yes, it is a headache. Yeah. I would agree. The sort of coming back to my thin end of the wedge argument, I'm worried that next time we'll be hearing that, well, a dollar a week is certainly not enough to cover the real costs of responding, especially when you're maybe dealing with this for the first time. It may take you 20 minutes to figure out how to do this. So I'm worried that we're going to be seeing this escalating in the future.
Yeah. Now, my question to you, David, is the job more important? Because I can see some crafty employers just saying, you know what, I don't need you anymore. Have a nice day. This is an at-will employment state. I don't have to give you cause. Just see you later. Goodbye.
Mr. Chair, I believe, although I've not looked at this recently, I believe that there's a statute that... No, at one point, I think Oregon had a statute that protected employees from discharge on the basis that they were being garnished. I'm not sure that that's still in effect.
Again, an employer doesn't have to give a reason for discharge. Just because I see you, don't need you anymore.
Mr. Chair, I would agree that the job is more important.
All right. And would you agree that there's a cost to the employer for processing a garnishment?
Mr. Chair, I would agree with that. I would also agree that there's cost to the employer for processing federal taxes.
Employers would argue they shouldn't have to pay federal taxes either. So.
Mr. Chair, I would say that there's a cost to the employer in processing payrolls, and I would look at this as part of that cost.
Well, and I don't know if Mr. Perry is prepared to answer this, but I'm assuming a lot of businesses use payroll processing firms or accountants that do their processing. And my assumption is that if, as an employer, you said, I've got an employee who has a garnishment and I need to have this processed, would you please do that, that there is an additional charge that the CPA or the processing firm charges back to the employer. So it just seems reasonable to me that employers would have enough to recover at least some of their costs. So.
Well, I don't know how much those charges would be. I can only assume that you're probably right, that there would be an additional cost.
All right. Thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
All right. We'll close public hearing, and we're adjourned.